This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he is every show, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. But Matthew and I aren't the only ones here today. We're also joined by a very special guest, the man who brought Nog to life, Aaron Eisenberg. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's so wonderful to have you here.
Yeah, really excited to have you here. I don't know at all if you remember, Aaron, but about a year ago, I actually got married, and it was so cool because we're acquaintances on Facebook, and you just said, hey, congratulations, and I was super excited. I mean, like, so I got married that day, and the person who played Nog on Star Trek Deep Space Nine said congratulations.
Oh, that's cool. Oh, right on.
Yeah, so thank you. I'm so glad I actually get to tell you thank you, sort of in person.
Oh, no problem. No problem at all. I hope everything is going well with your marriage and everything is great.
Oh, it is great. Thank you very much.
That was my pleasure, and I'm glad I was able to see it on Facebook. You know, you don't always see everything, and sometimes it's nice and fun to be able to do that. So I'm glad that made you happy. So thank you for mentioning that.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much.
Well, Aaron, we want to talk to you a bit about Nog, of course. And, you know, that character evolved so much over the course of the show. And can you think back to when you first got that role? What was the process like of actually landing the role of Nog?
So when I first got the role, to be honest, I had no idea what a Ferengi was. I remember getting the audition and I didn't think really much of it. I thought, oh, okay, cool, another audition. Another opportunity, and I went in to collect the sides for the audition and get the script if there was one. And Ron Cirma, you know, called me in real quick and said, "Hey, do you know what a Ferengi is?" And I said, "No, I have no idea." So he gave me a copy of The Last Outpost, and so I took that home to review along with the script. And to any aspiring actors out there, if you ever have the opportunity to get the script, please do. Very important to get the script because you never know what questions they will ask you in the meeting or in the audition. So always when you have that opportunity, acquire the script and read it. So needless to say, I watched The Last Outpost. I'm like, oh my God, that's what I'm auditioning for. Okay. That's pretty crazy. So I obviously, rehearsed, went over my lines and went over the script and what I thought was going on. Went into the first audition, and it was very strange to play a Ferengi out of makeup, especially, you know, when you're emulating, you know, The Last Outpost, which these guys with wits and they're all snarling, you know, and stuff like that. So I do the scene where I meet Jake was the audition, and it was a very intimidating audition because you walk in and there's one chair, and in front of the chair is a long table, and behind the long table are about six, what seem like 6 to 8 people. There's David Livingston and Rick Berman, and I think Ira was there and a slew of other people. And I remember David Livingston asking me, so you've got a worm inside your body. And I said, and this is what I'm talking about reading the script. And I go, No, I'm not a Trill. I'm playing a Ferengi. I'm playing Nog. And he goes, oh, you read the script.
And I'm like, yeah, and oh, so you know what a Trill is, too.
one point in my favor for paying attention to my character and knowing what's going on. So I did the first scene, and it went very, very well. They were very pleased. I left, and then I got a callback. And in the callback, I went through the same process, same scene, but I don't think I did it. I think I was, my nerves got a little bit of the better of me, and I did the scene, and I don't think I did it as good as the first time, but needless to say, I got the call that I booked the job. And I think part of the reason why I booked the job too was I think I did well, very well in the first audition, which gave them confidence. And secondly, the fact that I was an adult and I was only 5 feet tall, because Ferengi are short and they wanted to make sure that whoever they hired wasn't going to grow to be 6 feet tall and become a problem, you know, years down the road. And I think, you know, really that role was quote unquote written for me. I don't think it was really written for me. I don't think anybody knew me and wrote the role for me, but I think I was just very fortunate in who I was and what the role was, and very, very, very fortunate. So I got the role, and then the rest is history, as they say, you know, it's very, very fortunate. Mm.
That's really, really cool. I kind of wanted to know a little bit too. You start off as a more minor character, and you're the friend of Jake, and this role really grows over time. So I'd love to hear just about, for you, growing in that role and maybe kind of the surprises that came along when you would get scripts and they would be more, you know, Nog-centric than you maybe ever thought they could be at the very beginning.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. You know, to be honest, when I did the first episode, I had no idea how big the role would become. As a matter of fact, as I've said throughout the years, I always felt that every episode was my last episode. That at any moment, Rick Berman had a script underneath his arm that just sent me flying out the airlock. That's it. He's not up to par, so we're not going to hire him anymore. And in a way, that was good because it kept me on my A game. It kept me competitive. It kept me making sure I was always doing the best I possibly could. And it's funny when you look back on, you know, hindsight is 2020, and you look back on the decisions you make and how things turn out. And I really believe that, you know, Nog was very, very parallel to my own life. He was such an extension of my own life. You know, this kid, this Ferengi kid who's chasing his dreams outside the norm of his society, so to speak, and not always succeeding, but constantly picking himself up and trying again, you know, wanting to do the best he could, wanting to please the people above him and be successful. And, you know, that's how my own life was. You know, acting isn't a life that most people choose. You know, it's not an easy life. I personally think any career you choose is probably not easy, and it's competitive, but you know, acting is a pretty scary endeavor. And sometimes these days when I'm not making as much money or I'm not working as much, I sometimes doubt, you know, you doubt the decisions you make. But in the life you chose and the decisions you make, you give it your everything. And acting, you know, my mom supported me, and I dropped out of college to pursue it because I felt like if I didn't give everything into it, that I wouldn't succeed. And it's a life that a lot of people don't choose or choose for a period of time and say, oh, it's not working out, I'm going to go back to the corporate world or what have you. And never trying to make that quote unquote regular decision is tough sometimes. You know, you see people with, you know, sometimes a lot more money, a lot more things. And sometimes you go, did I make the right decision? And it's hard. And at that time, it was very important for me to make that decision. And I think making that decision is really what changed my life and got me to where I got to. And I think Nog does the same thing in his career. You know, he's a Ferengi and he's choosing not to do business, not to go into what the norm of his society says to do and to pursue something that's out of the ordinary, different, you know, shocking to his family, so to speak. And with that decision, he succeeds, you know, he finds success. And then he gets to a point where he realizes, did I make the right decision? And should I continue going forward? Should I keep doing this? Oh my God, I lost my leg. I could have lost my life. And he's kind of woken up to the fact that, should I have never done this? And he goes through a period of time, you know, kind of exercising those demons. And he comes out of it, and the question, you know, is, are you okay? And he's like, I don't know. I don't think so, no, but I will be. And he's unsure of what his future is going to be at that point, where before he was so sure. So he was so strong in his conviction. But despite that, he still takes that step forward, which is a great, it's such an inspiring character for all of us in our own life. Is when we hit those moments in our life, which we all do, what do we do? You know, what is the right decision in that moment? Is it really a wrong decision if Knox says, I can't do this, and he goes back to being a typical Ferengi? You know, who knows what his future would be? Or is the right decision going, I don't know, but I'm going to take a step forward because this is all I know, and this is what I really want inside my core, inside my heart. So the only thing that's sad was that was the last season.
Yeah.
I want to see what happens next. Where does his journey take him? That's what I'd really love to see. But unfortunately, I haven't been called to replay that character except in Renegade. So, and I guess in the book, he goes far. So, it's interesting. It's interesting to see what would happen.
We know from The Visitor, when we saw Nog in the future, that he becomes a captain, right?
That's true, but that timeline got erased after whatever decision Jake did at one point. So now we really don't know.
Let me ask you, you mentioned the storyline where Nog loses his leg. When you got that script, that was a moment that was a bit different from what we had seen in Star Trek up to that point, where there were real consequences for a character, because normally it's very easy. You get injured, you get patched up, you're good to go. Mm-hmm. But here, like you said, Nog, being a Ferengi, decided to go into Starfleet. He follows this other path, and then he actually loses his leg, and it throws him into, as you said, this moment of questioning. When you received that script, how did that impact you, your life at that point in time, in just the way you were thinking about things, or what did it make you think of?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it impacted my life or what I was thinking of and stuff like that. I mean, to be honest, you're just thinking about, this is my job.
Yeah.
And they're giving me they're putting a lot of trust in me. And I was extremely honored that they were putting that much trust into me for a whole episode. And really my thought process is, I want to do the best I can. So you go to work, what's going on, and you take hold of the script and you start, learning, start figuring it out.
Yeah.
So that's really what was going on. It wasn't anything more than that. It wasn't like, oh, wow, Nog's going in a deep, dark place and da 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 da. It's more like, okay, Nog is going into a deep, dark place. And what does that mean for him? What does that mean for a Ferengi? What does that mean? How does he handle that? How does Nog, if he's going into a place where he's unsure and he's hiding from the world, how does he respond to that? How would Iruk respond to that? And then how would Nog respond to that? So that's really how I approach it. I didn't approach it much more than what they were giving me in the script and how I felt Nog would honestly be in that place. Hmm. It really wasn't any different than any other script I had for the first six seasons. What's going on for him? Where is his head at? And how would that be represented in that character? And I felt that, when people, myself included, get into a place where they're turning themselves off from the world, they shut down. They shut down. They close off. Like they almost put a wall up, they put a huge wall up and they shut out the world and they don't want anything to do with it. And it's almost a metaphor to like drugs or addictions, when people can't seem to take a step and they don't want to make a choice. So they make this choice to prevent them from making other choices. And Nog's drug of choice was the holosuite. He was addicted to the pain reliever that the holosuite gave him. He didn't have to deal with his problems. He didn't have to deal with his fear of the future. He could escape. And that's what was going on for him. And throughout the years, people would label it as PTSD. And as much as I think there is a correlation or that's what was going on with him, that he was having a post-traumatic stress disorder, I honestly saw it more at that time as closing off the world around you and finding almost an addiction that prevented you from having to move forward. And in order to do that, he went into the holosuite. He found a pain reliever. And anybody that tried to get him to see that, he was like, screw you, F you. I don't have anything to do with you. I'll punch you in the face. Get out of my way. And so you saw a different, a darker side of him because he was closing out the world around him. And we all do that when we get in those places. We close out the people that are closest to us. We shut down. And it's funny because I remember reading a review at the time because that episode was so, so important to me to succeed for myself, to be successful. And someone said, oh, he's not himself. Terrible performance. That's not even Nog. And I was thinking to myself, what are you talking about? Of course that's not Nog because he's in a completely different place in his life. He can't be the same person. He's not the, hey, how you doing? I'm jovial. I've got all this energy. I'm very happy. And I'm positive. And I move forward. And he's not that. He's like, shut down. Don't come into my space. He's all in his head. He's cerebral. So that's how I approached it. That's how I saw it. That's how I attacked it.
Yeah.
And they gave me a lot of good stuff in that script to do that. And the time he breaks down, the time you really see what's going on is when Vic pushes him to get out and he breaks down out of fear. It had to be an outpouring. It had to be a waterfall. It had to be this dam breaking, this fear, everything coming to a head, you know, you know, you finally, somebody cracks and then it's all out. And then he's like, it's not so bad.
Yeah. Well, I think it was a great story. It really, I think it was a good turn for the character. I think it actually said something and it's one of my favorite episodes personally.
Yeah, I've gotten so many compliments on that over the years at conventions, and I can't tell you how many veterans have come up to me and complimented me. And you know, it's anytime I talk about it, I get emotional. I start to cry, so I'm trying not to cry. Very, very sensitive show to me. Very interesting how it was so important to me.
Well, that I think that was one of the things, you know, about the character was that he became so personable, and you had such a great on-screen relationship with Serac because you guys spent so much time together. And so I would love to hear just about, you know, especially at the beginning, you know, the big beginning of the show, most of your scenes take place with him. And I just wanted to hear about how you guys got along on, and just your experience with working with somebody like him who was a little bit younger than you were. So, you know, in a lot of ways, you know,
but your dynamic was supposed to be that you were best friends.
Exactly.
You know, and you were kind of the same age. So
I'd love to hear about that from you.
Yeah. You know, I was very, very fortunate on that show to have the cast members like Serac, that especially I would say Serac in this situation right here. I mean, you can talk about Armin and Max in a separate conversation, but in regards to Serac's playing, you know, obviously he's a 14-year-old young man, and it could have been any type of 14-year-old young man. Without naming names, I could have gotten somebody that was a lot different than Serac. And the fact that I had somebody like Serac, I couldn't have been more fortunate in who I had as a co-star. He was phenomenal. He was so wonderful to work with that our friendship continues to this day. I mean, we don't hang out. I think for a sense of we don't like each other by any means, but we're very different places in our life or what have you. And actors are such gypsies, you know, and you say, oh, let's get together and you try and you never do. But anytime I see him, it's like a reunion. It's like back in, you know, in high school and you see somebody 20 years later and the jokes you had, the camaraderie you had, it's right there and it never seems to go. And you're like, why do we keep making the same jokes? Why do we keep playing the same game? And it's just because that's the connection you have with that person. And with Serac, that has lasted throughout our whole life. And that story that I'm kind of referring to is that when I first worked on the show, I was in makeup. So he instantly thought I was his age. So he instantly had his wall down and was jovial with me and open and upfront. And so we were joking around and And because I guess I'm a bit immature or a bit lighthearted or a kid at heart, we got along really well. And he saw me out of makeup. He was like, oh, my God, you're an adult. Although I still look really young. But he knew at that time that I was older. And I go, yeah, man, I'm always like, oh, whoa, I thought you were a kid. And that was really the only conversation we had about that. And ever since then, we really got along and played off camera and worked very well. One of the games we played was this silly game of this middle finger where you had to get the other person to see their middle finger. And it's a game we still play to this day at conventions.
So how does that work?
Where you put it down I gotcha. Now the other person had to get you, and whoever got each other the most, obviously, is more successful, so to speak. So we'd play this game all the time, and we just really got along. And the other thing is, he was so professional. He was on top of the script. He was always there. He wasn't late. He knew what was going on in the scene, and he was ready to work and do his job. So I couldn't have had a better co-star. I was very, very fortunate. And I think the influence that he had with Avery even made that stronger. You know, they had such a huge relationship, and it was so important to keeping him on track and professional. And it just, everything worked on that show. We had such a wonderful cast. Everybody was professional. Everybody did their job. Everybody came prepared. Everybody mm-hmm. came to the table. I don't think I could ever get a show that had everything all together, from the production to the crew to the cast. Everything worked. Everything fell into place. At least from my perspective, it did. Maybe somebody else's perspective it didn't, but from mine, it couldn't have been more perfect.
So another thing I wanted to ask you, I've had one of your fellow Ferengi, Armin Shimmerman, on one of my other shows before, and we talked a good bit about stage acting and how that plays into being on Star Trek. And I know you did a lot of stage before you were on this show. Can you share with us your thoughts on stage acting? And I know so many Star Trek actors are stage actors, very successful ones, before they get on the show, even on DS9, you know, Armin, Renee, and of course you. How did that influence and help you with the scripts that you got on DS9?
Well, I can't say that I was that successful on stage, not compared to a lot of stage actors that, you know, are working in New York, on Broadway and off Broadway and what have you. My stage acting was, I would say, a lot more minimal. I did have some opportunities that I was very successful at. I did some improv at a local improv group in Studio City. I think really the major stage play that I did was at the Arizona Theater Company, and I did a play called Minor Demons. It was an equity play, and I received a Zony Award, which is Arizona's Tony Awards, you know, for their theater for that year. So I received a Best Supporting Actor Award for that, which I was just blown away on, I have to admit. Cool. I totally did not think I was going to win it. And I remember going to the award ceremony and receiving it and just being kind of blown away. Needless That's to really say, cool. Theater, you know, obviously in theater, I mean, in all acting, I think, is the same core, which is playing the honesty of the character. The main difference between theater is generally you need to be a bit bigger and larger than life to make sure you can reach the person in the back of the house. There's also a lot of physicality in understanding where you stand and facing the audience and movement, you know, upstage, downstage, stage right and left, which is a lot different than acting for film and TV. I think that staging can help and hinder you depending on the actor that's getting into a film or TV show, because, you know, in theater, you're very physical in how you move. And a lot of your movement is very, it also tells the story. You know, you're not just speaking with words, but you're speaking with your body, which is very important in theater to also communicate what you're dealing with, what you're thinking and what you're doing. So a lot of that can translate very well into a character like a Ferengi that's in makeup. I think, to be honest, the casting and the producers prefer to get actors from stage, or at least that are a little bit larger than life, mm-hmm. because they know they're going to be in makeup and they know they've got to be able to kind of get through that makeup or not have the makeup a hindrance, so right. to speak. A lot of actors, you know, will feel when the makeup's on, they're like, oh my God, they're not going to be able to see my facial expressions and this and that. But the truth of the matter is, it's not really about the facial expressions. It's about what's happening behind the eyes. And no matter what mask you're wearing, your body and everything about it and how you're talking and the inflections in your voice and the truth of what you're saying and doing will come through no matter what makeup you're wearing. And that's, I think, the kind of actors that they were looking for, the ones that had trust in that, that had faith in that. So I can't really claim that I'm one of those actors. I mean, maybe they saw that in the audition, but I don't think you would see that looking at my resume about all the theater I did, except if you thought, well, I did a lot of improv, so you could see that. He did win the Zony Award for this play. That's a positive. His audition demonstrated that. Oh, this sounds like somebody we're going to go for. But considering like somebody like, I think like Renee or Armin or Jeffrey, I think when you look at their resume, I think you see that more clearly and then might call them in, you know, and you would also see it, especially in Jeffrey's work. You know, I mean, that amazing actor who does so many different characters, and he's phenomenal. And I think that's what they were looking for. And I think with me, I think they might've seen that in the audition because I let it go. I went, okay, he's a Ferengi, and my arms come up all, I know who you are, Human. You know, I'm doing all this Ferengi stuff as well as playing the truth of the scene, which was really just meeting Jake.
Yeah.
And I think they then saw that. I don't think you'll have a problem with the makeup. And honestly, I think they, as they would say later, we just kept giving you more work because you kept doing it. You kept stepping up to the plate. You kept demonstrating your ability.
But I think what you describe about the stage and the techniques behind it, I mean, that confirms, you know, what I was thinking as well in terms of stage acting and why you were able to play through that makeup so well, because maybe you didn't win as many awards as Armin or Renee or Jeffrey did prior to being on DS9, but you had the training and the understanding and that stage presence. And I think that's really key.
I don't know. I think I just overact.
I don't know about that. I think you did a great job.
I had an audition once for Tall Tale. That's what it was. Tall Tale. And the cast director did not like me. She did not like me. And I remember auditioning. She's all, this is film, not stage. Tone it down. Bring it way down. And I think I've always been a little bit larger than life, just even in my personality. So I think a lot of things kind of came together for me, for Nog. I just think, as it was in the stars, as they say, I just think a lot came together for me. And I was not hindered by the makeup, and I never felt claustrophobic, and I never felt that whatever I was saying or doing was not coming across. I never felt that way, not once. But a lot of actors do. You know, a lot of actors struggle with that makeup. And I remember once the makeup was on and the teeth came in, I'm like, ah, there's Nog. It was like putting on a shoe. It's like, you know, putting on your favorite shirt. It just fits. And that's ultimately, you know, where I found Nog.
From now on, we're going to refer to it as putting in the teeth.
Yeah.
I love that.
And I still have those teeth. I did the voiceover for Star Trek Online, and I used the teeth.
Oh, right.
Oh, awesome.
I got a lot of compliments on that voiceover. It worked out really, really well. I was very proud of that. Came out really well.
Well, you've played Nog for such a long time, you know, working through 7 seasons, and I suspect that it is kind of hard for parts of yourself not to leak into that character. And so I kind of was wondering, what parts of Nog were mostly you that you feel like? And then where were parts of your life that you really drew on to help inform how you'd like to play the character as well?
You know, I think when you start, at least on a TV show, you have one script. I think I had 2 scenes to kind of get an idea of Nog. And ultimately, my inspiration came from The Last Outpost. It really started there. It started as, you know, he's kind of hunched over a little bit. He's a little snarls a little bit and, you know, and has this kind of grovelly voice. And you have no idea about the character other than what you've created for that episode. Or unless, you know, some actors may put more work into the character and say, this is his past and this is his future and this is his whole thing set up here. I have to be honest, I don't think I went that far and did that with Nog at the beginning. I kind of came up with a physicality. I came up with a voice, and then I just put my own energy behind it. You know, he's stealing something, and what's it like to steal something? He's caught. You know, he's meeting Jake, and the inspiration's like, I know who you are. What do you want? I have nothing to do with you. You're just a captain's son. You're just a punk, you know? So he's kind of like this, got a little chip on his shoulder kind of a thing. And then all I did, was really just put myself into that and maybe ramp it up a few notches is really where I started. So you start with this little mold for me, start with this little mold. And then every script I got was like sculpting that mold. So I get the next script. I'm like, oh, now I'm learning a little bit, something more about him. So now I've got to add this to that mold. So I add that in there and I push that in. And then I get the next script and I push this part in. And then I get the next script and I put that in. And all of a sudden, after a few seasons, you have the mold of Nog. You kind of see where his heart's at. You see where his mind's at. You see where he's going and where he's been. And so really the journey that I took with him was the same journey that everybody else took with him. I didn't go so deep as to say, this is his whole backstory. And, you know, he was on Ferenginar and, you know, he was this big ladies man and da 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 and all the girls, you know, and he was running a gambling establishment and da 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 da. I didn't even know anything about Ferengi other than The Last Outpost. So I was only, 23? So I don't think I was as good of an actor then as I felt I became after the 7 years.
Right.
I think I learned an immense amount about acting over those 7 years by almost being a bit overconfident and just stepping up to the plate and doing it and just trying to do my best, be as truthful to every scene that I had and being as honest as I could about the character. But I wasn't this method actor about it, I should say.
Do you remember any particular episodes or scripts, storylines that were your favorites from the series?
Yeah, they tend to be the same that are favorites for others. You know, Heart of Stone was a great one. I really loved Valiant. I love what they did with Valiant. Visitor was great, but the Visitor made me a bit intimidating to me because it was very difficult to play a future of a character that I have no idea what his future is and how he got there. I was kept thinking, well, what's Nog like older? How is he physically? How does he sound? What's happened to him between now and then? I have no history. I have no information. I have nothing to go on other than the script. So I was a little intimidated to play him older. And I thought, well, physically, the best way I could play him is to slow him down. Because what happens to most people as they get older, they kind of slow down a little bit. Mm-hmm. They get a little bit more wise, a little bit more mellow, but he's still Nog. So that was kind of how I approached it. Heart of Stone was my favorite, one of my favorites outside of Paper Moon. But at the same time, it terrified me because I thought I was off the show. But I found out that was further from the truth. But every time I got a script was a good day because I was working. I was a working actor. I was making money and I was doing what I loved to do. So every time I got a call was fantastic. I was always happy to be there, no matter what role I was playing. Oh, and the other terrifying day was the day I had to do the dance in You're Cordially Invited. Because
yes,
in the script, that day was supposed to be one of the easiest days in my 7 years. It was supposed to be a day where I'm just in the party. I'm just in the background. I'm just showing up in makeup and collecting the paycheck. I'm just hanging out, having a good time. And I'm sitting there in makeup before anybody else gets to the set, because I usually get there earlier because I have to get makeup. And David Livingston, the director, comes up to me and he goes, Aaron, good morning. I'm like, hey, what's up, Dave? And he goes, hey, the top of the scene, I want you dancing. So come up with the dance. And I'm like, what the beep? Are you kidding? A dance? I'm like, I didn't say that. I'm like, oh, absolutely. Sure. No problem. That's my job. And I'm like, Armin's not there. So I don't have a book that I can look to page, you know, page 25, dancing, not Ferengi dance. There's five top dances in the Ferengi culture.
The Guide to Ferengi Dancing. You should write that. You should get that published.
Yeah, I have no idea. You know, does he dance, you know, where were we in the late 90s, you know? Does he dance? Like, hey, he's just moving and shaking. I'm like, no, it's boring. He's a Ferengi. Can't just dance like that. I think to myself, is he going to dance like, you know, like Elaine from Seinfeld? I'm like, no, it's too easy of a choice. I can't do that. I can't be Elaine. And I'm like, oh, my God, I don't know what I'm going to do. I have no idea what to do. And it was probably the most terrifying day of the 7 years. I had no clue what to do. And I remember, luckily, we shot something else first, and I was standing behind the knob. And I said, this is ridiculous. I can't come up with a dance. I have no idea how I dance. How does a Ferengi dance? And I was getting kind of more agitated and more frustrated. And I turned around, and I put my arms up, and I go, ha, 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 and I do that. And she goes, oh, my God, that's funny. That's funny. And, you know, it's time to make a beautiful woman laugh. You're like, oh, yeah? Okay, that's cool. That's cool. I'll do that. And then I go, oh, yeah, and I'm going to add this in there just because I'm pissed off about this. And I turn around and I shake my ass at her. And she starts cracking up. And I go, really? That's funny? And I go, okay, I think I have my dance. And I'm so scared because I'm thinking, if I don't have something, and he comes to me and says, that's not quite working, I'm going to be like, I don't have anything else, man. I don't know what you want from me. I have no clue how we dance. I just don't know. So I was really terrified, and he starts off with the scene, and I'm there. He goes, okay, I want to see what you got first. And I'm like, oh, my God. So the camera's behind me. Everybody's behind me. Everybody, background, crew, are watching. And I'm just sitting there going, oh, you've got to be kidding me. This is terrible. I'm going to fail miserably. And I'm sitting there with my eyes closed, and I'm just like, oh, my God, here we go. And he calls to action, and I sigh, and I just go, well, all or nothing. So I go for it. I'm all shaking my butt. And it's going on for like 2.5 minutes. I'm like, oh my God, I'm running out of breath. Stop the camera already. Finally, I hear this cut. And everybody starts cracking up. Everybody starts laughing. The prop guy comes up to me, bats me on the back of the shoulder. Oh my God, man, I needed that so bad. That was great. That was so funny. And I'm just thanking every god I've ever heard of that this succeeded. And then they loved it so much, it became part of the scene. It was improvised into the end of the scene. Terry loves like, oh, we got to pull him into the middle and I'll start dancing with him. Then they cut to Armin and Ciroc and they're shaking their heads at me like, oh, my God, Nog. And that wasn't part of the script and it just became all part of the scene. And now to this day, it haunts me. Everybody always wants me to do it. And terrible. It's terrible now. And will never leave my side. But that's how it happened. And
that's great.
Great story. And scariest day of the 7 years.
It's a great story. And it works really well on camera, too. It's always entertaining.
Yeah, it did work. And it did look like that's the way Nog would probably dance.
probably so.
You believe it. You believe that if you went in and all, it's like your friend who's got all this confidence. And you're like, God, he looks like an idiot. But he just doesn't care. But that's Nog, you know, it worked. So anyway.
Well, Aaron, thanks for telling us all about your time on the show here with Nog. Now, the next thing you have coming up is on Halloween weekend. And this is one thing we also want to talk about. And this is a big convention that's taking place in Florida on Daytona Beach called 2050 Daytona Beach. And it seems like a bit of a new type of con, just the way they're pulling everything together and the approach that they're taking. When did you get involved in this and how did you get invited?
Oh, I think one of my agents got it for me maybe about 2 months ago or a month. Yeah, maybe 2 or 3 months ago, I think. She worked her magic and got me in on it. So I was very happy about it.
Very cool. How's the convention experience for you? Is that something that you really love doing and meeting the fans?
Yeah, you know, I do enjoy it. It's been such a wonderful benefit to me as an actor to meet the fans, to go to conventions, to travel the world. It's been such a blessing that Star Trek gives. I hope it continues to give until I can't go anymore. I've had such great experiences. I've never had a bad experience. I've been to Italy, I've been to Germany, I've been to Australia, all these places that I probably never would have been able to go on my own. And it's been a blessing. And the fans have always been really nice and generous and kind to me. And I've always had a great time. I've been very fortunate in that capacity.
I'll have to get you here to Japan sometime. We have to have a convention and make sure that you're here.
I always ask why we never go to Japan or China. We never go to the Far East, ever. I've never heard of a convention there. I would so love to come to Japan. Oh, yeah. My God.
Star Trek is not a big thing here. Star Wars is quite big here.
I don't understand that.
But Star Trek's not a big thing here. But a convention kind of like this one, kind of like this 2050 Daytona Beach, where they're really bringing together, it's not just Star Trek, and it's not even just science fiction as we think of it, but, you know, they've got Jaws, Aliens, The Terminator, even video games. They have all kinds of things going on. That kind of thing would be big here, I think.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, I hope they're successful. I hope it's a successful con. You know, it's one of those things, you if you put all your eggs in one basket or you spread them out amongst several baskets, it can go either way. So I hope it's a good con, and I hope a lot of people come out. It'll be great to see Anthony Montgomery again. I really like Anthony a lot.
I'm glad there'll
be somebody that I can hang out with, at least for dinner. And I'm really looking forward to it. And I always hope cons are successful. Because if they are, then they repeat and they come the next year and the next year. And then hopefully they'll bring me back again several years later, you know, and that they're having a good time and they're able to, you know, acquire an income to keep the con going. And so I really do hope it's successful. I always hope for the best. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. And if it is, then they'll do it again and again, or at least even if it's just, if they make a little low or they break even, they're able to redo it again, get bigger stars or other actors, and then just keep going forward. It's always great to have cons being successful. It's good for the fans, it's good for the actors, and it's good for the promoters. You know, it's a win for everybody. So I really do hope it works out for everybody.
One other thing that they're having as part of this is called Imagine 2050, and it's a kids expo. And in fact, kids 12 and under get in free with a paid adult, and they also have 50% discount for students. So I guess we can't call them kids at age 13 necessarily, although my kids are that age and I still call them kids, but 13 and up. But it gives a chance for, you know, kids to get involved in a con and kids to get to meet the actors and all. What's it like? I know you have a son as well. How old is your son now?
Oh, I have two boys. They're 18 and 16.
18 and 16. Okay, wow. So a little bit older than my kids, but not by much. How do you feel when you're at a con and you get a chance to actually meet children who are becoming interested in the work that you've done?
Oh, I mean, especially when it's in a second or third generation, I have to admit, it kind of blows me away that I just think, wow, it's just this juggernaut just keeps moving forward. It just keeps inspiring people and bringing them in. And it's always wonderful to meet a young fan, especially if he loves your character and he relates to him and it means something to him. I mean, it's always great to experience that. To be honest, it's great to experience any age group, male or female, anybody that loves your character and is inspired by it or just even just enjoyed it, enjoyed your work, you know? It's nice to hear good things about what you've done. Always nice to hear that. I need more work so I can, you know, continue to work and, you know, continue to enjoy doing what I love doing. Kind of been raising my kids over the past 18 years, and now that they're older, I've been trying to find my way back, and it's been a bit of a struggle, you know, to find my way back to get to working. That's why it's nice to do Renegades. I did a pilot called Cosmos this year, but I need to work again, you know. I need to find a way to work again.
Yeah. So to wrap up the con bit here, so people know, you're going to be there, and what are you going to have available? Are you going to be doing autographs? Or are you going to have photo sessions with you?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I'll have Nog photos. I think I need to find a way to get some photos from a movie I did called Puppet Master 3 or uh-huh. horror show for Star Trek. Cause I think it's also a horror con. Okay. So I need to try and get those kind of photos if possible. I'll have my photos there and probably I'll have some of my photography artwork there for sale as well. and just come out and have a good time and meet the fans. And hopefully there'll be a lot of people that will come by the table and say hi and say they enjoyed the show. And it'll be a good con, you know, just hoping for the best.
Awesome. So for everyone who's interested in going, if you are in the area, October 30th to November 1st, Halloween weekend, 2050events.com is the website, and the event is 2050 Daytona Beach there in Florida. So go check Aaron out there. Now, Matthew, I know there's one other thing that we want to talk about here.
Yeah, Aaron, we know that right now you are on kidney dialysis, and wanted you to tell the listeners just about your situation. And I think it's always a great thing to be able to talk about to bring awareness to people who are in the same situation as you are.
Yeah, and maybe someone listening can even help.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that it's funny how I got the role of Nog because I'm short. I'm only 5 feet tall, and they needed to make sure that they had an adult that wasn't going to grow. And I'm short because I was only born with one kidney, and that one kidney was defected. It didn't work as well as most people's kidneys work. It worked fine until I was about 13. And when I was 13, I went on dialysis then. And then at 17, I had a kidney transplant. It's funny because that was probably the inspiration why I went into acting, because when I was pursuing acting and I was going to college, I thought to myself, you know, I don't know how many years I have. You know, I could lose my kidney in two, I could lose it in one, I could lose it in four. And right now I'm 18 and I look 11. Right now I have an advantage in the industry. I want to go for it. I don't know what my future is going to hold. So that was part of the reason that inspired me to get into acting. And lo and behold, my kidney almost lasted 30 years. So my kidney transplant lasted until this year. In August, I started getting sick. I thought believe it or not, I really just thought I had the flu or pneumonia from the Star Trek creation convention in Vegas, because so many other people had gotten sick from that convention.
Yeah.
So for 2 weeks, I really didn't go to the doctor. I didn't do anything. And then after 2 weeks, I remember I had a job. And I couldn't do the job. I was just too physically ill. I slept for a day and a half. Finally, I woke up. I went to the doctor that night or that late afternoon. He took my blood. Next day, he said, Aaron, you're in kidney failure. You need to go to the hospital now. This was Tuesday, I think the 26th. And I went in on Wednesday, the following day. Yeah, the 27th, I went into the hospital. And then I went on dialysis the 27th, immediate dialysis. I pretty much went on detox for the next 2-3 days. I got out of the hospital on Monday or the 31st and started regular dialysis on September the 1st, which became a three-day thing, three times a week. And since then, I went to the hospital again with an infection, but I'm better now. And it's been a rough 2 months, an adjustment. And at the same time, I've been more stabilized and I've had more energy than I did before I got sick. So now I'm on dialysis. I'm on what's called hemodialysis, which is what most people are aware of, where you go to a dialysis center, you're hooked up to a machine. They basically clean your blood for 3 hours by taking the blood out of your body, running it through a machine, and putting it back in your body. And the good thing about everything is, as I said, I have more energy, so I can continue to work. And that's what I was most afraid of. And what I'm really waiting for is to get onto peritoneal dialysis, which is a different kind of a dialysis. It's more, you do it yourself. You can do it at home. It's a little bit more flexible and better for you. So that's what I'm trying to get to next. But it's hard to get onto that because I have to have another minor surgery and then some training. So I'm kind of waiting for work to dissipate before I can do that. I'm also on the transplant list at UCLA Medical Center, and one of the goals that I have not been able to put into place is getting registered at other hospitals to help increase my opportunity to get a kidney. So as of now, they say my wait time is 5 to 7 years. I don't think it'll be that long, but that's what they say. So hopefully I can get into, again, some other hospitals, which will decrease my time waiting, hopefully. So that's kind of everything in a nutshell. And you can always find me on Facebook. And there's, you know, I'm trying to put up a Facebook page about my journey to get a new kidney. And and what have you, and possibly seeking help if I need some in that regard. And there's been a few people that have tried to be a donor, so we're waiting on those to see what happens with that. And that's pretty much it. That's pretty much where I'm at right now. So there's nothing else you can do but continue to move forward, you know, do what you have to do and continue to move forward.
But so a question here, because I'm not familiar with the process so much, you're on a waiting list at the hospital and you can get on the waiting list at other hospitals. But if someone wants to be tested and is a match and wants to donate, does that work outside of the waiting list system? Is it possible for someone to just directly do that?
Yeah, that's correct. It does work outside of the waiting list. If you get a donor and they're a match, then you can get the transplant. And what they'll also do sometimes is, let's say you have a donor, but they're not a match for you, but they're a match for somebody else, and that other person has a donor that's a match for you, they'll do an exchange where they'll do like a two-person, even three, four, five-person surgery to transplant all those kidneys to the available donors in that chain, so to speak. So that's the other thing that can happen if somebody's willing to be a donor.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, domino surgery. Yeah, those are pretty intense, but very cool.
Yep.
Okay. Well, we will certainly have you in our thoughts, and I hope that it all works out smoothly and certainly doesn't take 5 to 7 years. And if any of our listeners, you know, are interested in finding out if they're a match, I hope that they will do that. And any other way that we can support you, of course, you know, the whole fan community is always here for you.
Thank you very much. It means a lot to me. It means so much that there aren't any words to ever say thank you, especially to somebody that donates. But that's probably been the biggest struggle for me is how do you say thank you for something like that? Very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. It's something I've been struggling with because words just seem so trite. So even in your offer or when the fans offer and the fans send so many nice things on Facebook, it's very hard just to say thank you. It just seems just doesn't seem to be enough. So hopefully I can get to conventions and more conventions in the following year or two and thank a lot of the fans in person and say it again. So hopefully that'll come true.
I certainly hope so. All right, Aaron, well, we're going to let you go. We don't want to take any more of your time tonight. Again, people can find you Halloween weekend at 2050 Daytona Beach, 2050events.com. Apart from that, if people want to find you in social media or they want to see what's going on, what are the various places where they can find you?
Oh, they can easily find me on Facebook under Aaron Eisenberg. That's pretty much, I'm also on Twitter as well, but I'm not as good on Twitter as I am on Facebook. So usually I connect with people on Facebook more than any place.
Okay, great. And I guess your next film project is Cosmos, right?
Well, no, that they did earlier this year. That's a pilot. But the next one I think we recently booked is Renegades for next year. So hopefully that will continue to work out for me. And hopefully I can do another. I did a Star Trek Online voiceover, and hopefully I'll do another one next year or the year after. So hopefully,
excellent.
Hopefully I'll have some more work next year. Every year I say that, but I'm hoping next year will work out.
Awesome. Great. Well, I hope you'll come back and talk to us sometime in the future, Aaron. And thanks so much for your time tonight.
Absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for having me on your show. So I wish you continued success with your show as well.
Thank you, Aaron. Have a good night.
All right, guys. You too.
Chris, that was just an amazing experience getting to talk to Aaron and hear about his work on Deep Space Nine and elsewhere. And just, you know, I think one of the coolest things about getting to talk to him like that was just he is just as personable and as nice as, you know, Nog was, you know, as a character. And it's so wonderful.
Not emissary Nog, though, right? Later.
Yeah. But it's so wonderful, you know, when you meet somebody like that and they blow away every expectation you have of meeting somebody like that to being even a better person than you thought. You know, just it's so awesome. And I really appreciate just him coming on. And man, I hope more than anything, too, that somehow, you know, maybe the show is helpful for him in, you know, getting better physically. I really encourage anyone who has an interest in looking into that and helping Aaron out, please find a way to get in touch with Aaron and make that a possibility.
Yeah, I hope so. It's tough, you know. I mean, I've dealt with a few small health problems myself and had some surgery, but nothing like that. And that's difficult, but you know, he's been working through it his whole life, and I'm sure things are going to turn out well here moving forward. But if anyone can help, or if anyone knows anyone who can help, yeah, please look into it.
Definitely.
Well, yeah, I really appreciate Aaron's time tonight talking to us and hearing those stories about the show. I love that he actually whipped out the Nog through the teeth voice for us there on point. That was wonderful.
It was awesome. Awesome.
So everyone, if you want to share your thoughts on today's show, there are many ways that you can reach Matthew and me. Of course, we're on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. We have our Facebook page, facebook.com/TrekFM. We have our contact form on the website, trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and choose the orb, and that will come to both of us by email. You can also send us a voicemail if you go to speakpipe.com/TrekFM. But of course, as we always mention, the best way to join in the bigger conversation is to come to the Babel Conference on Facebook. Matthew, for new listeners who don't know about the Babel Conference, tell them briefly what that is.
Well, the Babel Conference is our listeners-only discussion group that we have on Facebook. And really, as you were saying, Chris, it is a fantastic place for people to get the opportunity to interact with all of us from the network and to do it in a way that is safe and fun. And what I mean by that is that it is a listeners only group. And so you do have to be a listener to know about the group. It is private on Facebook, so you do have to be asked to be let in. But what that really does is give us the opportunity to talk to one another and have people who are really invested being there. And I have to say, Chris, I think we just have a phenomenal group of people that are there. There's nothing like being a part of the Babel Conference and the discussions that we have going on there. So I really do hope that, you know, if you enjoy the shows here that we have on Trek FM, and we have so many, that you'd want to be part of the conversation and really kind of just come in, be part of the family.
Yeah, definitely. It's a wonderful place. And the way you find it is to just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook. And that'll take you right on in. And just click join, and we'll let you on into the group. We hope you'll join us there. And also in that group, we talk about all the different shows on the network. So if you're not familiar with them, here's a quick look at what else we've been talking about on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And they've added something completely new and fun. I don't think anybody would have ever thought, you know, before this, you can't fix perfect. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know, but I'd say that they made it more perfect.
Earl Grey.
Daddy, do pets have a Nexus too?
The Pexus.
Kirk had a dog in the Nexus too, didn't he?
Butler. Butler is now Shadow. So we have the adventures homeward bound of Butler, Porthos, and Spot. Will they make it back to their owners in Montana?
The Orb.
If he had like a game card, his power, you know, like would be higher than any other captain for their persuasion power.
You'll be like, damn, I was winning. And then he went and played a Cisco card on me.
The Ready Room.
Someone pointed out that this is actually the shortest title of any Star Trek episode. It's shorter than Voyager's Q squared by half a character because the two is superscript.
We're number one. We're number one.
To the journey! It's fake intimacy.
Thank you.
It is them trying to say Chakotay knows Janeway so well that just by fiddling her comm badge, he knows the crap's gonna hit the fan. Commentary, Trek Stars.
Here's a quick question. Is the Blu-ray the correct aspect ratio?
The aspect ratio, you've opened up a can of worms,
okay? I'm just telling you right now.
I know that I have, but the thing is, it's because of you that I even cared.
Okay.
The 602 Club.
I think you've hit something here, and I've never thought of it this way, but the true savior of the galaxy, it's not Obi-Wan, it's not Luke Skywalker, it's Aunt Beru.
Literary Treks.
Reagan's a great guy to bring up because his dad was this raging drunk, and you know, he had to sort of drag him in on off the porch at night because he'd come home like falling down drunk, and you know, you think of, and here he was, this kind of great man for the country at the time, but he came from a place that was really kind of dark and also very relatable.
Women at Warp.
Infinite diversity and infinite combinations, even though it's not necessarily always realized that, that we're looking at it through the lens of our time. But that ideal is there, and striving to be better and to be more inclusive is such a noble goal.
And introducing Meta Trex.
For Odo, the instincts are so powerful, they sort of override every other factor, every other value, every other choice that he has. And I think that's the point of this view of determinism, that all actions that look like they're freely chosen are really just instinctive behaviors of one, in one variety or another.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what else we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find our shows everywhere you get your podcasts. Of course, we're on iTunes, where we're a featured content provider. You can just go to itunes.com/trekfm, and that will take you into our artist section. You can also find things on our website at trek.fm. You can find us on Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, BlackBerry, SoundCloud. We're all over the place. And on our website, if you go to the show page, you can get the RSS link and put that into any app that you like. I'd also like to remind everyone that we are a listener-supported network. Our listeners support us through Patreon, and we really appreciate everyone who is doing that. That makes it possible for us to cover the costs of producing and distributing all of these shows. It's very expensive to run this network. And we would especially like to thank our associate producers here on The Orb, Ruth Ward, Will Wynn, and Ken Tripp, for helping us get this show out to you. And if you would like to become an associate producer or simply help out the network bit by bit, you can do that at patreon.com. Every dollar makes a big difference for us. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And just last week, we launched Patron Zone, which is our new website just for our Patreon patrons, where we give you early releases of most of our shows, as well as all kinds of other special wallpapers and ringtones and avatars and other exclusive audio content.
Oh yeah, Chris, I got the ringtone. That's right. I've got the...
Did you get one?
Yes, I did. I've got Larry Nemechek on my phone, as well as having the barrel roll. That's right. So I am Trek FM'd up on my cell phone these days. It's awesome.
Those are awesome. And you can get those for yourself there in Patron Zone. The URL for that, if you're already a patron, is patron.zone. That's the actual URL. And if you are a patron, go to patreon.com. And right there in the sidebar, actually below our avatar, you'll see a link to the post that has the password for this month. The password changes every month. So anyway, please consider supporting us through Patreon. We really appreciate all of your help, everyone who is contributing out there. Now, Matthew, when you're not practicing delivering your podcasts through prosthetic Ferengi teeth, where can people find you?
Oh, goodness, Chris. Man, does that take time and effort? But when
but
I'm not doing
so
that...
good, Matthew.
Yeah. Well, thank you. You can't even tell that I've got them in right now, can you?
No, you're getting good at it.
Well, you can find me on Twitter, of course, at MattRushing02. You can also find me doing Literary Treks with Dan, where we talk about the books and the comics of Star Trek. And, you know, Chris, if there's anybody out there who's kind of lamenting the fact that we don't get a lot of the Prime Universe anymore, well, honestly, Literary Treks is a fantastic place for you. You learn about the books and the comics that we talk about, as well as getting to interview the authors, the latest books. So that is, I think, just a key place to be these days. And of course, we've also got the 602 Club that I host, where we pick a great new geeky topic each week and dive into that, talking about new, old, and everything in between. So come on over and let Ruby serve you up with something nice. And you can also find me at my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Now, Chris, when you're not practicing your Ferengi ass-shaking dance, where can we find you?
Matthew, we've been talking about this for years now. You've got to turn off the feed from those cameras that you planted in my studio.
Okay, fine.
Okay, are they off now? Is that a click I heard?
Yes. Life is going to be so much more boring now.
I know. You'll get over it. Well, you can find me elsewhere on the network doing The Ready Room, where we cover all 5 live-action Star Trek series, and I'm always joined by a different co-host and a different panel of guests every show. So we have great discussions over there. We also cover some Star Trek news. I also do a short news show from time to time called Hyper Channel, as well as Continuing Mission from time to time, which is about fan films and independent productions. And then in the podcast world, you can find me doing a non-Star Trek podcast called Metropolis On Air, which is connected with the magazine that I run here in Tokyo. And that covers events and life in the city, and I do interviews with various people, and we do Japanese language tips and all sorts of stuff on there. So if you just like to hear me talk for some reason, and you don't care if it's about Star Trek or not, you can find Metropolis On Air in iTunes and some other places, and you can also go to the website metropolisjapan.com, and you'll find it on there. And back to Star Trek, when I'm not talking, if you'd like to read my writing about Star Trek, you can find that on the official website at startrek.com. My column there is called Trekspectives, and my latest column is out called Fighting Time, and it's all about how time shapes the way we live our lives, the way we perceive time. And actually, Matthew, it's something I've been struggling with this past weekend as I try to get so much stuff done, and I simply can't. There's not enough time.
Oh, Chris, we just don't have enough time to talk about time because, well, honestly, we just don't have the time.
We don't have the time. But I do have the time to tell you if you want to find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. That's also my username on Facebook and pretty much everywhere. And I'm also in the Babel Conference. So drop by there if you want to chat Deep Space Nine and other Star Trek with me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time as we gaze into the orb.